we have Mr. Paget and Mr. Jeffrey.
Morning.
Good morning. Counsel, I want to make sure that you either now at the conclusion of your argument that you sign your sign-in sheets, please, if you'll endorse those for us. We appreciate it. And would you like to reserve some rebuttal time, sir?
Yes, ma'am. I reserve 5 minutes.
Okay, you certainly may have it. And whenever you're ready, sir.
Yes, ma'am.
May it please the court, I'm Dirk Page. I represent Emily Aponte, the appellant in this case. She was convicted of involuntary manslaughter, DUI, maiming, and child abuse. Three issues for the court are the Fourth Amendment issue involving the search and seizure of the blood, the crash retrieval data, and sufficiency of evidence on the DUI. And without taking any particular in order, I'll start with the seizure of the blood. The facts of the case are a little complicated. When you're looking at the facts, you got to read through it. You got three state troopers on the scene, on a chaotic scene. You got a small child receiving medical attention. The mother's hysterical. She drank Dr. Pepper, still with the side. Prior to the troopers showing up, she had thrown three beers together over into the woodpile. Connie Letchford, who arrived on the scene, testified that she said, "Don't call 911 or don't call law enforcement authorities, I've been drinking." That was the indication there and upset both of the Letchfords, Cheryl and Connie. Connie Letchford never smelled alcohol. And Aponte readily admitted that the night before she'd been drinking a lot of alcohol. That was it. When the trooper later testified, he smelled no alcohol in the vehicle. Three troopers got within range of this person. Never smelled alcohol, ever. One witness testified they smelled alcohol. She said it was strong. That was Cheryl Leverage. And she was behind Connie. And Connie never testified she smelled alcohol. In fact, she didn't. The trooper allowed them to leave because the child was in distress. At no time did he suspect at that point the consumption of alcohol. They went on. Her testimony is she consumed alcohol. He doesn't know. When he got to the hospital, later at the suppression hearing, court ruled it was an exigent circumstance that allowed the drawing of the blood. But if you look at the testimony of the trooper, he never, ever said he was in a hurry. The trooper testified there was no hurry. I was outside my three-hour window. I was not in a hurry. When he got to the scene, they conducted the investigation. There was not a scramble to preserve evidence. There was no getting a nurse to preserve the evidence. They conducted an interview. At that time, a lengthy interview. At that time, he smelled a slight odor of alcohol.
Counsel, let me stop it just in reference to your factual recitation. In terms of the not in a hurry, that was really in context as it related to the implied consent. He knew that he was outside of his time frame, isn't that correct?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, so he was testifying in reference to that. And in reference to, I guess we're going with the facts is in reference to whether there were exigent circumstances in terms of the probable cause for that. But the trooper was told by Ms. Letchford about the beers being thrown out after Ms. Ponte had left the scene.
Yes, ma'am.
And soon after he completes or finishes up the investigation, he leaves to go to the hospital, and it's at the hospital where he notices a faint odor of alcohol.
Yes, ma'am.
So what happens now is we get to the two PBTs.
Now he's interviewed.
Right.
Knowing what to do, he calls the Commonwealth Attorney in Bedford County. The Commonwealth Attorney instructs him to ask her to consent to a blood draw.
But that's after the two PBTs.
Yes, ma'am.
He's gotten one that's
got
a 0.13, then he's got the other that's a 0.10. And what happens at that point, though, is he has a discussion with her about whether she wants to sign the consent or not, correct, in reference to, or be taken down to the magistrate.
No, ma'am, I think at that point, if I remember correctly, he called the Commonwealth.
I'm sorry, I meant after. I'm talking about after he called the Commonwealth. right? There was
right. Right. Commonwealth directed him that she does consent, take her to the magistrate, get a search warrant. There's an officer living there. That's strange. And so that was there.
So you say, did it come also if she does not consent to take
if
her
she does
the,
not consent to the search warrant,
okay.
Take her to the magistrate to get a search warrant.
Right. Right.
This is not proper. And she's at the hospital. So there's going to be a blood draw. It's going to be happening there. So at that point, then, quite honestly, the instruction should have been, go get a search warrant. She's not going anywhere. She's at the hospital to stay with her child. The time elapsed would have been de minimis.
But wouldn't he have had to secure her presence or someone with her? Because wasn't there testimony that he would have had to have called in another trooper to come in and secure her?
I don't think he testified. It was to come in and get the affidavit. He wanted to stay at the hospital, but 10, 15 minutes, he would have been in Roanoke City Magistrate's office. Get through search warrant, come right back. He knew she refused to leave. She initially didn't want the blood draw because she'd have to leave the hospital. He knows she's staying right there. Go get your search warrant, come right back, get the nurse, draw your blood. It's that simple. Instead, it was coercive measures to get the consent. They know she wants to stay there with her child. If you don't give me that blood sample, I'm place you under arrest to go get a search warrant. Not place you under arrest for DUI. Place you under arrest to go get a search warrant. And it's significant because the Commonwealth argues that inevitable discovery. She was not placed under arrest at the hospital. This was a direct indictment months later after the blood results came back. So there was no arrest. And so with that, you have an illegal seizure of her blood because she acquiesced to lawful authority. If you don't give me that blood, I'm placing you under arrest in handcuffs and you're going to the magistrate's office to get a search warrant. Not under arrest, to get a search warrant, which is not the procedure. So there was coercion to get the blood, and that's a violation of the constitutional rights.
But the trial court agreed with that argument in reference to consent, found that it wasn't consent, but in fact found that the taking of the blood was proper through exigent circumstances.
Yes, ma'am, he did. But he was the one that brought it up. The Commonwealth didn't even argue it in their brief.
But nevertheless, it's the court's finding, and I think that's why we're here.
It was. And I'd like to address the issue right now. The Commonwealth raised the issue. I didn't object to the ruling. I'll address it right now. If you look at the record of trial, Judge Updike issued his ruling. This is the way Judge Updike rules his court. You say anything you want, you keep talking. You say anything you're going to say. You say anything you're going to say. Oh, no one's talking anymore, so I'm going to talk. You're not going to abandon Judge Updike. He's going to give you a ruling. He's not going to argue over your ruling. And at the end of that, you see, he says, objections of counsel noted for the record, of course, and preserved for the record. Is there anything else, gentlemen? What else do I do now? See, he's gone. He's moved on. But the court acknowledged the objections of the defense. The court acknowledged those objections, and he ordered it preserved for the record. And that's what I would ask him to do if I stood up. He did it without me saying it. Because that is the way he runs his court. I'm not going to abandon with you. I've ruled. And your objections were noted. And so I didn't have to stand up. And if you see right after that, the line of testimony. What's next, counsel? You move on. The second phase of that, unless you wish to carry on that inquiry, is the crash retrieval data, which I wanted in the evidence to show the lack of gross and wanton conduct, plus the issue of intoxication.
How is that not harmless error, so Collins indicated, because she's ultimately convicted of the voluntary rather than the aggravated?
The case law introduced by the Commonwealth was a Wyatt case that showed falling into the other lane is prima facie evidence of gross and wanton conduct. Here, didn't have that. Here, duly testified he was the driver of the van involved with the maiming incident. The vehicle just didn't come into his lane. It was a gradual move into his lane. Her testimony and her statement on the scene to the trooper was that she turned to ask a question to her child. As anyone can imagine, when you turn to answer a question, and this is a country road. This is not a marked by a line. This is a country road. And as it glides off to the left, duly testified that vehicle was gliding right toward me. Now you have momentary inattention issues, not gross or wanton conduct. Also, the issue of intoxication, anyone can do that. You don't have to be intoxicated with that. If you're driving over in someone else's lane, that's evidence of intoxication. But inadvertent moving to the left because you're distracted, momentary distraction, is not evidence of intoxication. And she should allow that in the evidence to argue she was not intoxicated at the time of the offense. Lastly, it's an issue of sufficiency of the evidence. The only evidence you got on the scene is really Cheryl Leffridge, who was excited on the stand. In her initial direct testimony, she never said anything about alcohol. Her mother-in-law, Connie Leffridge, never smelled alcohol. If you look in the photo scenes, you see Dr. Pepper all over the place. And on the scene, there's a photograph. She's drinking Dr. Pepper. Same Dr. Pepper she was drinking at the time of the crash. There was Dr. Pepper all in the car. The three bags of beer came from the night before, and when she was thrown that away. Stupid? Yes. Because people don't understand the law. They catch beer. If a cop catches me a beer, I'm in trouble. People want to hide it. They're not drunk. It's legal. They don't know that. They don't understand the law. She was there a significant amount of time with three state troopers who were trained for DUIs. One of them came with it and retrieved her license from her. One of them, Trooper Musgrove, was talking direct to her. These are old troopers. They've been there forever. I know I was a prosecutor in Bedford County. They've been there forever. I prosecuted many a DUI with these guys. They know to look for the slurred speech, the staggering. Things to look for in a DUI. If those troopers had suspected of drinking, she would not have been allowed to go to the hospital. She would have not left the scene. Had no evidence of it. None. And she's on her way to the hospital. And there's testimony about how that happened. The drinking subsequent to that. The evidence is inconsistent. And it's important to note, the Commonwealth never argued drinking after the night before. The entire Commonwealth's argument, they can't rise above it. That's what they argued. They never argued she drank later that morning. She never argued she could have been drinking later that morning. They never speculated at all. They were fixed. By 4 o'clock the prior morning, she stopped drinking. And evidence would have been, if you go to the retrograde extrapolation like they wanted to do, which they didn't stop to do it, as the circumstances would have been nothing for them. If they waited an hour, they could still do the retrograde extrapolation. It wouldn't have mattered, because Dr. Wright could take it all the way back. And if you listen to the testimony or the transcript, it says, at that time, her BAC would have been 0.4 or 0.39, which is the lethal dose. How possible? What made sense was she drank after the accident. So, with that, we'd argue that insufficient time at that time to argue she was drunk at the time of the accident. Just because you think you may be liable for something. I got beer on me. I've been drinking the night before. Does not mean, under the law, you were drunk at the time of the crash. That's not what it means. And the trooper is the key. All three of those troopers, they were in the car. There's no smell of alcohol. Not on her. Only later at the hospital. Now let's reserve the rest of my time. I think I have 1 minute and 43 seconds left.
Thank you, Mr. Page. Were there any questions before?
No.
Thank you, sir. Mr. Jeffrey.
Good morning, ma'am.
Good morning. Yes, almost you're making it just in time.
To please the court, Thomas Jeffrey on behalf of the Commonwealth. I think I've addressed most of the things on brief. I'll start, I guess, with the timeliness of the Fourth Amendment objection. And I would note, I didn't go back and look at the transcript, but I'm fairly certain as I stand here that at the suppression hearing, the court sua sponte made the exigent circumstances ruling. And there was no timely specific argument made. And that is the key to this, I'm preserving your objections is not enough to do it. That the issues that are before the court are much more fleshed out in terms of exigent circumstances. I was discussing this with the trial prosecutor this morning. This isn't one of your suppression hearings that happens a couple days before trial, because clearly the judge, sua sponte, came up with this exigent circumstances thing. That's one reason I laid the timeline out. This hearing was several weeks before trial. There was ample opportunity to object. The first effort to ever do that is after the evidence is concluded, which, of course, at this point, you kind of get into that idea of unnecessary mistrials because the jury has already heard this evidence. They haven't been instructed to go back in the box yet, but that it's not timely enough to take corrective action. That's the key point on the default and the waiver with respect to the Fourth Amendment issue. Again, I didn't look back at the transcript from that suppression hearing, but I'm fairly certain that there was not any specificity. And I cited Creamer in elsewhere in my brief for another point, but I think that does a pretty nice job of reciting the issues with respect to waiver and timeliness and specificity. I would certainly commend that to your reading on that point.
I hate to interrupt you. Assuming that waiver is not an issue in reference to the Fourth Amendment, would you agree that in reference to McNeely, which might be controlling or impactful in this particular case, that McNeely essentially says that you just can't have the per se rule for exigent circumstances in terms of the dissipation of blood?
That's correct, Your Honor.
It doesn't say that it can't be a circumstance or, in fact, a sole factor, just as a case-by-case determination.
No, and in fact, Your Honor, as I pointed out on brief, the court, it's a very narrow snippet of it, so you have to look for it, but Birchfield actually reiterates that point.
Yes. Birchfield's in reference to implied consent, though. It's different than just the exigent circumstances.
Oh, it absolutely is, Your Honor. I didn't mean to suggest that it was an exigent circumstances case, but what they do in Birchfield, and I quoted the very specific language in there, is they essentially reaffirm the notion from...
And they set it up again and say, not always.
Nothing that would prevent da-da-da-da-da, okay. And if there are exigent circumstances. So I think that sort of ratifies that concept, because I did think there was some suggestion on brief that, on my opponent's brief, that there is a per se rule that you need a warrant to draw blood. And he wasn't trying to suggest that, and I'm mistaken on that point. But what I am clear on is, as far as the law goes, you can still get blood through exigent circumstances, post-Birchfield and post-McNeely. You know, I laid out on brief all the exigent circumstances in this case. I would point out, as I did on brief, that the court very specifically, I'm assuming this is as a result of an amicus brief that was filed in McNeely. I can only imagine that's where they got this. But they made a point of saying that while you can do retrograde extrapolation, that the ability to do that credibly does begin to dissipate over time, because there's more efforts for the defense to kind of poke holes on the analysis as more time has passed. They made that specific point in McNeely. So I think that's important in their analysis here, because as we know here, several hours had passed after the accident. So I think the suggestion that you can, just because the Commonwealth was ultimately able to do retrograde extrapolation, does not carry the day on that point. And again, I'm quoting directly from the Supreme Court's opinion. That language was also the pertinent language was in my brief. I think, Judge Malvo, you addressed the language about not being in a rush. I don't think it has the broader applicability that the defense has suggested, for the reasons that you stated earlier. I've cited throughout my brief various efforts that the defendant made to conceal her conduct, and I know there was some cross-examination that kind of poked at this, but certainly we had some evidence. I've got very specific sites in the brief that she distanced herself somewhere from the crime scene. We know she refused medical treatment. All the types of things that created a situation where it was more difficult for the troopers to see this. I would also commend to the court, and I didn't talk about this on brief, I think this is a common sense proposition. Don't know anything about Ms. Aponte's drinking history, but from 797 to 799, the Commonwealth's toxicologist talks and presents sort of the common sense thing that some people are able to mask these things better than others. And I think that's an important point to keep in mind. I also think it's important that you've got troopers out there that are working two different, they're monitoring two severely injured individuals on scene, because the driver of the van was, a lot of testimony in the record about the nature of his injuries, and of course the victim in the past had serious injuries on scene as well. I talked about inevitable discovery. We know the trooper intended to take her to the magistrate and get a search warrant. The standard in Jones is laid out. Jones makes a point of saying, and I'll quote the language to you. While the Commonwealth shouldn't be in a better position than it would have been if no illegality had transpired, the prosecution should not be in a worse position because of some earlier police error or misconduct. We know that the trooper was prepared to go get a warrant if consent was denied. And I think for that reason, inevitable discovery certainly applies because of Jones. We know that he was prepared to do it, even from the defendant's own witnesses established that he had indicated that he was going to take her to the magistrate. I don't know if he ever used the word arrest, per se. I think he probably did at some point during his testimony. If that's important to the court, I can certainly mine the details. But I've outlined on brief his specific testimony. You know, I would only say two things as I close out. If the court doesn't have any questions on the Fourth Amendment issue, if the court doesn't have any other questions on the points that I've just addressed, I haven't conceded consent. I understand the trial judge's position on this. I would point out to you, I think it's page 1266. I think the judge clearly thought this was a legal ruling, which I'm only suggesting to you because I think that means you could potentially revisit it. I don't think.
Let me ask you about that, because that's an interesting issue in reference to the consent. The court appears to make certain factual findings in reference to the consent issue. Do you want to speak specifically to those rather than just the legal arguments as it relates to consent?
Well, I think to the extent that the trooper's testimony describes his actions as being, I'll use the term less draconian than the Commonwealth's witnesses does, the defense witnesses do, I think we're stuck with that. I think the legal point, and I cite you to O'Neill as historical fact, it's definitely a plainly wrong standard. What I would take some issue with, and I don't have a case for this, but I would suggest to you that when he gets to the point where he's making a finding that she was in an untenable Hobson's choice position, that does potentially become legal. And that's the only suggestion I would make to you. I don't have a case for it.
I was going to ask if you I haven't seen any authority that stands.
I don't, and I think I probably looked. I think the better course is exigent. The better course is inevitable discovery. So I didn't spend a lot of time on it, Judge, but I certainly cited cases from other contexts that say, just because you have a hard choice doesn't mean the Constitution's violated. We know that her own volitional conduct put her in the position where she had this hard choice, and I think that would be the point that you would have to grapple with if it were an issue you had to reach. I'll just leave it at that. The black box, as I argued, and I know the officer testified that's not really what it is, but I'll call it a black box. I think clearly harmless for the reasons I stated on brief. There was no evidence that she was speeding. The fact that she didn't apply brakes and that she swerved at the last minute, all also consistent with somebody who is intoxicated and not reacting well. And then, again, the totality of the evidence, I think, also fits into a harmless. But I think even if you analyzed it in a vacuum, I think that that's clearly harmless. I think that's your clearest way out of this, because it's just so compelling in this case. I would only say that with respect to the abuse of discretion standard, just because you would have let it in doesn't mean there's an abuse of discretion. It's a newer technology. What the officer said about the tuning, the tuning force, what the judge said with vis-a-vis a radar, you don't have the external way to check it. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that judges wouldn't disagree with you. I'm not going to stand up here and tell you that other judges haven't let it in. I was counsel for the Commonwealth in Nininger and Dupree, which the officer actually testified about in assisting with that case. So I'm clearly not going to stand up here and tell you it hasn't ever come in before, because it has. But the point is, under the abuse of discretion standard, it's only when reasonable jurors could not differ. And I always cite Grattan. I would certainly commend the Knoll case from, I think it's 219 Virginia, that's cited in Grattan to your, for your reading. It's a medical malpractice case, and I have to say, I think most of the courts I've appeared in, the judge would probably throw me out of the courtroom if I made the argument that carried the day on the evidentiary issue in that case. It's a very tough standard. I will say that the defendant cited on brief a case saying that you review this type of thing de novo. The case that he cited, he correctly states that that's what it says, but it's very much an issue. That's NADA Blue Book, and the issue before the Supreme Court there was, we have a statutory exception, but even in the face of that, is there a Sixth Amendment problem? Which obviously is a purely legal issue, but when you're dealing with relevance, the reliability of evidence, you're clearly back in what I would call your core abuse of discretion standard. Not everybody would agree with this judge about the reliability, but that's not really the point. Finally, with respect to the evidence of intoxication, I also said that that's defaulted because there wasn't a renewed motion to strike with respect to it, a specific renewed motion to strike after the defense testimony under Murillo Rodriguez. That makes it untimely, or that makes it waived. And then I very clearly spelled out what the toxicologist said about retrograde analysis. She said it's the best, particularly in a situation like this where there's evolving testimony, even from the defendant, about her drinking history. There's no dispute on appeal that she did not drink. The defense admits that on brief, and in the light most favorable to the Commonwealth, she didn't drink after this accident. That's a key component of retrograde extrapolation. And with that testimony, the toxicologist puts her at a significant level of impairment. And then you have the other issues, the witnesses on the scene, the odor of alcohol, even at the hospital, that the officer smelled. And obviously, you're not required to accept the defendant's version of events. The jury was not required to accept this idea that she just got rid of the beer because she was afraid that the police would see that she had beer. There's three beers missing from a six-pack. The jury was certainly free to conclude, regardless of what the Commonwealth argued, and I take some issue with this idea that they were completely hung on this idea that she stopped drinking hours before. The jury, even if the Commonwealth had argued it that way, was allowed to conclude that her drinking was actually more recent in time in light of the totality of the evidence. Unless the court has additional questions, I would ask you to affirm the judgment.
No, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Mr. Padgett.
Busy tending people who are wounded. That's not the facts. The facts for EMTs were all over the place, over Mr. Dooley and the child. They stood back. They're working the crash. They had nothing to do with those people. They're there interacting and watching, and she's there the whole time. They watched her the entire time. When it comes to the issue of the warrant, he was not told to the magistrate to get an arrest warrant. He was told to get a search warrant. Clearly, it was meant to coerce her into giving the blood. You don't need the suspect to go and get a search warrant. And clearly, it was meant to coerce her into giving the blood draw. That's the key. And that's why the judge found it was involuntary. You can't coerce somebody under color of law. I'm going to arrest you to give up your rights to do something that's patently illegal. He wasn't going to arrest her, place her under arrest. He was going to take her into custody to go get a search warrant. That's what he was instructed to do. Even the trooper questioned that, but he did what the Commonwealth told him to do. On the issue of exigent circumstances, if you read through the record of trial, over and over I asked him, trooper, were you in a hurry to preserve? No. I was past my 3-hour window. She was interviewed twice at the hospital with lengthy interviews by social services
and the trooper. The trooper first, then social services. There was more than enough time to go get a search warrant right after the BACs. So I'd ask to reverse or dismiss the charges. I see I'm out of time. Any questions from the court?
No, thank you, Mr. Padgett. We'll come down and greet counsel. Thank you.
All right.